Coffee House Shots is sponsored by EDF, Britain's biggest generator of zero carbon electricity. Find out how we are busy helping Britain achieve net zero at www.edfenergy.com.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. It is 20 years since 9/11, and to discuss the impact on those events that we still see today, I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. James, clearly this comes weeks after the withdrawal from Afghanistan. What do you think the biggest consequences that we still see from that day are?
I think one of the most remarkable things about the last few months is, and you saw this in Joe Biden's speech, is essentially he is trying to close the book on post-9/11 US foreign policy. Post-9/11 US foreign policy was driven by the view that you couldn't allow failed states, that they became inherently dangerous because they became breeding grounds for terrorism, so you needed to intervene, stop that from happening. Joe Biden was saying in that speech, look, actually, what I'm concerned about is great power competition with China and Russia. We're going to give up on the idea of trying to remake countries, trying to kind of, you know, the kind of neoconservative vision of bringing democracy, spreading democracy around the world, and the belief that that is what would make the US safer. I think two things, which is, one, I remember being in Washington on 9/11. I think if you had said to anyone that day, there will not be, in the next 20 years, there will not be another major terrorist attack on the American mainland. You know, obviously there was the Boston Marathon bombing, but that was kind of fairly limited. I think people would have been very surprised. I think in some ways what is remarkable is that how relatively little terror there has been in the 20 years afterwards. That was not what people's initial reaction was going to be. But the second thing, which is quite hard to escape a feeling of, is that the policies launched in the wake of 9/11 have not succeeded. You know, the US has left Afghanistan after 20 years, and Afghanistan has fallen almost immediately back under Taliban control. The hope that the Iraq war would spark a kind of domino effect of democratization across the Middle East, you know, that has not happened. And in some ways, you can sum up Biden's position almost as, well, we haven't solved this problem, but maybe that's because this problem is insoluble. Let's get back to dealing with the threat posed by China. I mean, I am struck by how sometimes when you look at the Biden administration's foreign policy, it is like the last 20 years just didn't happen.
Fraser, I suppose to go back to that day, do you remember what you were doing when the news broke?
Yeah, I was working for The Scotsman and we had the television on, and we saw the first airport crash, and of course it was reported a civil emergency as you expect. And then the second one came on, and then somebody said as a joke they're under attack, and then it struck me that they were. And then of course anybody who was a journalist at that time will remember what happened, what you would then have to do with the front page. Almost every newspaper junked words on the front page and just put a picture. Because it was one of these events which transcended our ability to write about it, really. It was clear that history had just moved on massively. And then, of course, there was the question, the other feeling that America had been struck, so America would hit back, except who would America hit? Given that there were a bunch of Saudis, wasn't going to hit Saudi Arabia. So what would you do next? And then, of course, this opened. You had George W. Bush, who at the time was elected to office, saying he doesn't believe in nation building, who was sort of poo-pooing Clinton's attempt to try to improve things. And then you had a far more idealistic Tony Blair, who I remembered at the time basically feeling that the hand of history was on his shoulder. So he gave his Chicago speech about making the case for liberal interventionism. And I also remember how I backed Tony Blair, and I was fully supportive of the policies which, as James says, later went on to backfire. So what I've been thinking about recently is not only the tragedy of the last 20 years, and sure, James mentioned successes, although the fact that there hasn't been another terrorist attack is more a vindication of the intelligence community and its ability to upscale, intercept. I think the thwarted Heathrow bombing, for example, some of the most heroic stories in Britain's recent kind of, I don't know if you can call it peacetime, given the British history, they have not been told. They're about sort of things that didn't happen. And they are, there's no doubt, huge stories. But James, how long have you and I been working together now?
We have been working together now for 15 years.
15 years. So 2006, when we first started writing together, as you say, you were in Washington, you're working for Foreign Policy magazine. I was working for The Scotsman and The Business and pretty soon The Spectator. And you and I, my memory serves, agreed we were both on the hawkish side of the divide. And I'll tell you where I think I made the mistakes, and I'd be interested to know if you must look back at the same, James, and thought, like, why did I... There was a sense of optimism, which I shared, that history was moving in the right direction, that the collapse of communism had happened, that when a bad regime fell, there was a sort of historical gravitational force that would mean a better regime would come along. The people, that globalization meant that people wanted freedom, they wanted liberal democracy. If this wasn't the Western way of government, it was simply the future. And it was, look at what happened to Japan. Under American care, you might manage to develop this modern state which drained the martial poison out of its veins, and that you couldn't see why the same thing wouldn't happen to the Arab world. So there was a lot of idealism there. I guess you then, there's the neoconservative strain, of course, which, as we discussed on Spectator TV, came out of the kind of Trotskyites and their optimism about the perfectibility of human nature. If you're a communist, if you're in the far left, that is what you believe in. The conservatives tend not to be a bit more sceptical about the perfectibility, but in this case, not when it came to overseas. I should have retained my scepticism there, and I didn't. And then I basically also believed that there was a kind of moral responsibility for the stronger, more powerful countries to come to the aid of the ones that were weaker. And if they were happened to be subjected to a dictator, then you shouldn't shrug your shoulders and think, oh, well, that's the luck of the draw. You should do what you can when the moment presents itself to help the people of those countries. Now, I completely see now how this can be regarded as a neo-colonialist rhetoric. That's what the Victorians thought about Africa, for example. But it seems naive, and also it's naive about what it takes to grow democracy. It's not about a voting booth, it's about a pluralistic political culture. You cannot really send in troops and grow that. A whole bunch of things I got wrong, but I've noticed that people also, you know, are in my line of work, are kind of reluctant to admit what they got wrong, where your judgment failed, where you look back and think, because it's pretty big, way bigger than the Brexit, whether you're pro-war or anti-war. And I was on the pro-war side, and I was proved wrong. And looking back on that, it's one of the biggest misjudgments, I think, that I've made as a journalist.
James, do you think, have you changed your opinions?
So I think you can't look at what has happened in Afghanistan and Iraq and think that they are successes. To pick up on what Fraser was saying, I think the biggest thing is, I think that we had come to believe that democracy was the kind of natural state of man, and that, you know, if you remove the dictator, that what would follow would be democracy. I think it's been a lesson about that culture matters more than we sometimes wish to admit. And I think that, you know, just to pick up on something that Fraser was saying, you can't underestimate the optimism that there was because of what had happened in Eastern Europe. You know, the Berlin Wall had fallen, and you were then seeing democracies coming up all over Eastern Europe. And it seemed to be that in the same way that when the Iron Curtain fell, what followed was democratic societies, people wished to be free, but that there was a view that this was almost universal, that if you removed the obstacles, but that would happen. Now,
it's also pointing out that's in the context of a Cold War, where you were almost brought up thinking that the people on the other side of that divide just thought differently, but they weren't the same as us. And when the wall came down, they thought, no, that's not true, they are just the same, we are fellow Europeans. And so you can see the same argument being applied to the Arab world. Why shouldn't we think that they want the same freedom we want, that they want their girls to be educated, that they want their children to grow up in prosperous, globalised cities? So there was, James is quite right in saying that the optimism of the 10 years of successful integration of the former Eastern Bloc was being transferred on thinking, okay, what is next for the great liberalisation?
And then I think the other thing was the alternative solution. The idea that, you know, you would just have to rely on intelligence to solve this problem, you know, and that you would have to try and thwart these plots. You know, 3,000 people had just died in the middle of New York City. The view was that unless you did something, there would be more and more and more of these attacks. And I think in some ways, the withdrawal from Afghanistan is a sign that the West is simply less worried about failed states now than it was in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. You know, I mean, I remember when living in Washington, there was this huge pressure on Bush to react straight away. And I remember he said at a press conference, I'm not going to send, I think it was a $2 million missile to hit an empty $10 tent and only hit a camel in the butt. And that was like an argument, you know, because that is what the Clinton administration had repeatedly done in its attempt to kind of control Al-Qaeda. And I think what is remarkable is, you know, the US is essentially going back to that strategy. You know, Biden talks about, you know, how we're going to use over-the-horizon capabilities. You know, obviously now it's more drone strikes than planes or cyber delivering it. But it's essentially back to that mindset. And I think this is what makes the situation so difficult, which is, you know, you do wonder whether in the event of another attack, people would flip back again to the view that, you know, that something must be done. But I think I think the last 20 years, I think we have learned a lot, as Fraser said, about the importance that trying to bring in a political culture that didn't exist before takes a lot longer than contemporary Western societies have the patience for.
I've got a couple more thoughts on why, again, I felt the two things that I missed. One of them was, I say that I thought history was basically moving our way. That underplayed the fact that women were, for example, being veiled up at the time in the Middle East in the way they simply weren't in the 1960s. At the time, you could have looked at what was happening in Sarajevo and seeing the impact which this hardline form of Islam was making in a country which could have turned west, but it wasn't. The signs were there that we flatter ourselves. We talk about Taliban as being backward and the medieval, etc. No, they're actually incredibly modern. Well, their brand of Islamism is newly minted. As the writer Bassam Tibi argues, it's got its roots in 21st century totalitarianism, not in anything medieval and Islamic. So that was a form of modernity, but I think we didn't want to admit it because we can have thought that tomorrow belongs to us in the West. I think we found that out to be wrong. The other thing is, when you go through such a bitter, rancorous debate as the Iraq war debate was and the Brexit debate was, as a result, you do become a little bit more close-minded. As a result, I felt I wasn't as open-minded as I should have been to the signs that things weren't working out, and that for example, take what happened in Iraq. The kind of Sunni-Shia split, the fact that you had this, broadly speaking, Shiite country ruled by a Sunni minority, that wasn't given anything like the attention it should have been given. So, of course, you were going to get reprisals from the Shiite death squads who went on to cause such mayhem in Basra. That was a dimension of it which I think was overlooked, again, by a West which saw world history through the... As, by the way, some of the best met people like me as well, you saw world history through the lens of our recent history and not about the trend of politics in the Middle East and the rise of identity in Islamic politics.
I mean, there also was a naivety. I think one of the most amazing things that Tony Blair has said about the Iraq war is, you know, well, we didn't expect Iran to intervene and try and destabilise Iraq as much as it did. Well, what were you expecting? I mean, this was the mistake made. I also think there was a fundamental confusion about what the war aims were. I think, you know, Donald Rumsfeld and the Pentagon would quite happily have knocked out Saddam Hussein, you know, regarding it as unfinished business from the first Gulf War, installed Ahmad Chalabi as the ruler of Iraq. You know, maybe there would have been a kind of a democratic election to endorse him, but, you know, it would have been, sorry if you can't see the store TV, I mean, very much kind of air quotes, democratic election. And that would have been how you remade Iraq. And then obviously there were others who wished to stay and try and foster a kind of full-on democratic society in Iraq. And I think you had this constant confusion about in both Afghanistan and Iraq, constant confusion about what the war aims were. You know, I often think about Afghanistan, you know, if, as he so nearly was, bin Laden had been caught in Tora Bora right at the beginning of the war, Would the US have then bothered to stay in Afghanistan for the 20 years that it did? In some ways, the US presence in Afghanistan was a product of the fact that Osama bin Laden had not been captured or killed in the initial military encounters there. And so I think that confusion about what the West was trying to achieve is one of the big problems that led to the mistakes.
And Fraser, I suppose, touching on what James was saying, we have heard warnings that the UK and the West, the US, are more open now to terror attacks because of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Do you think if we were to see something like that, we could change foreign policy position again in terms of public appetite?
You're quite right, Katie, to point out that the public appetite for retaliation was huge after 9/11. especially in the States. After 7/7 in Britain as well, there is always absolutely huge, well, how did this happen? Let's make sure this doesn't happen again. I think Tony Blair went through his phase where he wanted to lock people up for 28 days without charge. Of course, it's funny that I can't, you know, since then, we're being told we're in various stages of alert. And that alert, to me, I lose track of what stage of alert we're at now, but it never basically gets much lower than, you know, threats are being compiled. And if you look at it's one of these things the intelligence services can't release, but the number of plots that they thwart is pretty big still. I think that is still a pretty big risk. And, you know, as Jerry Adams famously said, the terrorists only need to get lucky once. We need to get lucky all the time. So I still think that there is... I'm really surprised there haven't been more lone wolf attacks, for example. That seemed to be a trend once upon a time. It could well be that our intelligence services have, after a massive failure in 911, finally managed to get back and infiltrate and make sure that they can be present whenever two or three people gather together planning a kind of a plot. Certainly they've got a lot better at it. But, you know, might one of these plots happen? Absolutely. I'd be surprised if it doesn't, to be honest. And I don't think it's particularly linked to... I mean, I remember that we were worried after the Syrian war that we'd be having a terrorist attack because all of these ISIS fighters were coming back to Britain, that they'd be battle-hardened, they'd be planning an attack, and we were bound to get hit. That turned out not to be the case. The same argument can be said about the Taliban now in Afghanistan. They've opened the prisons, a lot of these guys are back out there, we're going to get a lot of refugees coming here, and in that slipstream will be bad people willing to do us harm. That's all possible, but the fact that it hasn't really happened anywhere like the same extent in the last 20 years should give us some degree of encouragement. What I think is depressing is the battle for the future of Islam. That is something else that we tried to change, we tried to steer. We in the West thought, okay, look at this, there's a small number of Wahhabis and hardliners, surely we can just take them out. And look to, for example, Singapore's more civic form of Islam as something we want to encourage. I think the Taliban's triumph says quite a lot about the battle for the future of Islam. And I think that's, again, a story the West doesn't tend to cover. One of the first things the Taliban did when they got back to control in Kabul was to have a massive kind of theological meeting about doctrine. In these countries, who controls the church and society runs the place. They're more interested in that than they are in society. And I think the attempts to reform Islam that we effectively embarked upon, Blair went through a phase of trying to encourage more moderate imams, of trying to root out the Diobandis from mosques, that completely failed and it went the other way. And I think we're still dealing with our lack of literacy and understanding the religious currents and just how and the conflicting directions that the Arab world is moving in now.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.